Okay. Thank you for the opportunity to speak at this event. The property industry has come to have an international element to it, as witnessed by today's event. Property markets are also something we monitor very closely at the Reserve Bank of Australia, and not only for their important impact on economic activity. Property can have a substantial impact on the stability of the financial system. The Reserve Bank does not supervise or regulate lending institutions in Australia. That's the responsibility of APRA. But the bank does have a mandate for the responsibility to promote stability of the financial system as a whole. In a stable financial system, all the various parts, banks, other financial institutions, and capital markets work together to ensure that capital can flow safely and efficiently between savers and borrowers, and that supports economic activity. The property market is important for financial stability for a number of reasons. In the past, banks have experienced substantial losses on their commercial property lending because of its large cycles. Residential property is also important for financial stability because residential mortgages account for a very large share of banks' lending in Australia. Because of the high value of household mortgage debt and housing assets, the property market also has implications for the resilience of households' balance sheets. Today, I will outline the connection of financial stability with commercial and residential property. Internationally, banks have experienced substantial losses on their commercial property lending in the financial crisis. In Australia, the performance of this commercial property lending also deteriorated, but losses were relatively moderate. However, Australia does have its own history in the early 1990s of large losses on commercial property lending, resulting in individual lenders needing to be rescued and threatening the stability of the financial system. In 5 years, Australian banks experienced losses of around 10% of their loans concentrated in their commercial property lending. This was a classic boom-bust or hog cycle story. The second half of the 1980s saw buoyant economic conditions, strong growth in commercial property prices and construction. A ready supply of credit fueled the boom. Following deregulation and the entry of foreign banks into the Australian market in the mid-1980s, the domestic banks competed to maintain their market share. Lending standards were lowered, and business credit grew by around 25% each year in the second half of the 1980s. With the economy overheating, monetary policy was tightened. Increased interest payments and the economy falling into recession resulted in rising losses on the business lending. Office prices halved from their peak as construction that had been initiated in the boom years in the late 1980s came to the market just as the market had been falling. Losses mounted at banks, with two banks having to be rescued and one major bank needing to raise capital. As notable as this episode seems, it's a script that has played out before domestically and has played out since then internationally. There are several aspects to commercial property lending that make it inherently risky and typically more risky than residential lending. A large share of banks' commercial property lending is for construction and development, including for large apartment buildings. Construction and development loans tend to be riskier because the property isn't yet earning rent, things can go wrong in the often complex construction phase, and market conditions can change in the several years or longer that it can take to complete large complex projects. Losses can also be greater on commercial property lending because borrowers with a limited liability company structure can have less incentive to repay loans than residential borrowers who face full recourse. Adding to the risk is that the availability of finance for commercial property has tended to be pro-cyclical. A booming market often has led to an easing of lending standards and borrowers' collateral constraints, just as demand for finance has increased. Relative to residential property, the greater ability for funding to come from outside the established market can also add to this cyclicality. Commercial property lending can be syndicated, and with large, relatively small, large individual projects, it's easier for new lenders to enter the market at low cost. The cyclicality of lending can accentuate the cycles in commercial property construction and prices. Foreign investors may add to the cyclicality of the commercial property market if they tend to enter the market when prices have been rising and more properties are available for sale. Alternatively, if foreign investors' decisions are largely influenced by conditions in their home market rather than the domestic market, they may actually moderate the domestic property cycle. Foreign banks' direct links to the Australian banking system tend to be relatively small, so their impact on domestic financial stability is more likely to be indirect through their impact on the amplification of credit and property markets. Historically, residential property lending has tended to be less risky for banks than commercial property lending. Indeed, the stress tests conducted in Australia by APRA have found that banks have sufficient capital to withstand a deep recession and a collapse in the housing market. However, the sheer size of mortgage lending on Australian banks' books means that residential loan performance is critical to their health and so that of Australian financial stability. The high level of housing debt is also important for the resilience of household balance sheets. In Australia, unlike many other countries, individual households also borrow to directly purchase investment properties, and that may add to risk as well. More than 1 in 10 taxpayers in Australia owns an investment property. Most of these are geared, and generally so much so that they do not earn positive income for their owners. While these owners generally start with smaller loans, and most debt is held by high-income households, they do have less incentive to repay their mortgage ahead of schedule because of tax considerations, and so they retain a higher mortgage balance over the life of the loan. Despite the high level of mortgage borrowing, various factors may mitigate the risk to the financial system. Housing debt is mostly well secured. Limits on maximum loan to valuation ratios and house price appreciation over time mean that most existing borrowers have a fair amount of equity in their property. In addition, the ability of mortgage borrowers in Australia to make excess payments on their mortgage reduces their balance and provides a buffer. Close to 2/3 of mortgages in Australia have such a buffer, which collectively amounts to about 2.5 years of scheduled mortgage repayments at current interest rates. As with commercial property, foreign buyers of residential property could amplify cycles or transmit foreign shocks. Non-residents purchasing Australian real estate based on unexpected returns can increase the correlation of the Australian market with other countries. Changes in economic and regulatory conditions in foreign buyers' home countries can also be transmitted to their demand for Australian property. But if purchase of Australian property by foreign buyers mainly depend on conditions in their home market, their participation could actually have a moderating impact on the Australian housing cycle. Having explained why we take a significant interest in the property market from a financial stability perspective, I would now like to provide an update on recent developments in commercial and residential property markets and the role that international participants have played. One part of the commercial property sector that the Reserve Bank has been watching closely is the development of residential property. The surge in apartments recently constructed and under construction now in the major cities raises the risks of price falls. The construction of new apartments has been largest relative to the existing stock in Brisbane and inner city Melbourne, though it is largest in absolute numbers in Sydney. Prices for other types of commercial property have risen sharply, with a strong increase in demand from international investors seeking the relatively high yields available on Australian commercial property. Exceptionally low long-term interest rates internationally have pushed up valuations for property and other assets, all the more so because relatively strong and stable economic growth globally have reduced investors' perceptions of risks in the current environment. While there has not been a surge in construction, the run-up in commercial property prices raises the risks of a sharp correction. Commercial office markets have been strongest in Sydney and Melbourne, with low vacancy rates and rising prices. In contrast, conditions have been weaker in Perth, given the downturn in the state economy from the decline in mining investments. Conditions in retail property markets have been relatively subdued across Australia. In part, this reflects strong competition in the retail sector from new entrants and online retailers. We've lost the graph. Anyway, there we go. Overall, Australian banks have tightened their lending conditions for commercial property in recent years. Restrained lending by Australian banks has provided an opportunity for new entrants into the market. Asian banks have grown their commercial property lending sharply, more than doubling their market share in just 2 years, although it remains relatively small. This strong growth in commercial property lending by Asian banks is reminiscent of European banks' growth in the lead-up to the financial crisis. However, this time, Australian banks do not appear to have eased their lending standards. The Australian residential property market has been strong in the post-financial crisis period, as interest rates have been kept low to boost inflation and economic growth. Since 2009, national house prices have risen by almost two-thirds, and growth in housing credit has outpaced that in incomes. By 2014, concerns about risks from an increase in riskier types of lending, including interest-only lending and investor lending with high loan-to-valuation ratios, as rising as indebtedness for households also rose. In response to these concerns, ASIC increased its security of lending practices, and APRA implemented several macroprudential measures in late 2014 and again earlier this year. On both occasions, after consulting with the Council of Financial Regulators, which the Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia chairs. There are several aspects to these regulatory measures. For each ADI lender, the growth of investor housing lending has been capped at 10%. Interest-only loans can be no more than 30% of new mortgage lending. In addition, APRA has been monitoring high loan-to-valuation ratio mortgage lending and instructed lenders to pay closer attention to the loan serviceability criteria, as well as interest rate buffers applied to new mortgages. These measures have played a role in reducing the build-up in risks from housing borrowing. Lenders responded to the restrictions by increasing their interest rates for interest-only loans and investor lending. In response, the share of new loans that are interest-only has been falling, and overall investor credit growth has remained below the 10% threshold. Many existing borrowers have also switched their interest-only loans to principal and interest loans, and there has been a decline in the share of new loans at high loan-to-valuation ratios. While riskier types of lending have moderated and investor credit growth has slowed, the pace of overall housing credit growth has remained fairly stable. Owner-occupiers' growth has picked up slightly. Conditions in the housing market have eased, particularly in Sydney, where prices had experienced strong growth, and given their high level, the lending restrictions had possibly had a greater bite. In Melbourne, conditions remain stronger than in other capital cities. On the other side of the country and at the other end of the spectrum in terms of housing market performance, conditions remain weakest in Perth. Prices have fallen gradually over the past 2 to 3 years, with rents also falling and the vacancy rate at the highest since 1990. The strong demand driving house price growth reflected not only low interest rates, but also strong population growth. With rising demand and prices, dwelling investment increased strongly. A notable feature of the recent cycle has been the marked increase in the share of higher density construction, a helpful response to the shortage of well-located land in Australia's major cities. Approvals for new higher density dwellings went from being less than half of those for detached dwellings a decade ago to being almost on par in recent years. But the longer time that it takes to build higher density dwellings increases the risk that a large number of new dwellings could come onto supply just as market conditions are easing, and this would amplify the cycle. This surge in apartment construction has been largest in Sydney, but has also been notable in Melbourne. While the number of apartments being built in Brisbane has been smaller compared to the population, it has been greater relative to the existing stock of apartments. Peak apartment construction in Brisbane is expected to occur this year, capping a 3-year period in which the number of apartments has increased by a third. Perth has also seen strong growth in the number of apartments from a relatively small stock. This change in the composition of the housing stock is resulting in a rebalancing of relative prices, with prices for detached dwellings growing faster than those for apartments. In the weaker housing markets of Brisbane and Perth, this has seen apartment prices experience small falls in recent years. To date, despite valuations at settlement for some apartments being lower than the purchase price off the plan, there have not been widespread reports of settlement failures or increases in arrears or losses for banks. Purchases by foreign buyers have received considerable focus in recent years. Non-residents are able to purchase newly constructed dwellings in Australia, while temporary residents can purchase existing dwellings if they're here for work or study. It has been hard to get a firm estimate of how large these purchases are. It seems, drawing on a range of sources, it seems that nationally, purchases by foreign buyers are equivalent to around 10 to 15% of new construction, which is about 5% of the total housing sales. The share of new construction purchases is highest in Melbourne and Sydney. It is also higher for apartments, but is still only perhaps a quarter of newly built apartments. Many foreign buyers are from China, perhaps around three quarters. Purchases of new properties by foreign buyers have eased over the past year, reportedly because of stricter enforcement of Chinese capital controls and a greater difficulty in sourcing finance for foreign buyers. Purchases by foreign buyers do not, on the whole, reduce the supply of dwellings available to local residents, and in fact may actually contribute to the increase of the housing stock. Foreign buyers in Australia for work or study would have been renting if they did not purchase. Other foreign buyers rent the property as an investment and so contribute to the rental stock. Also, there are some new developments that of what would not have proceeded if it wasn't for the large pre-sales of apartments to foreign buyers. The strength of the Australian property market and the participation by foreign buyers has also enticed some foreign developers into the country, generally for specific projects. But overall, foreign developers remain a small part of the market. Foreign banks have also entered, but remain a very small share of residential property lending in Australia. Given the significance for financial stability, the Reserve Bank carefully monitors property markets. History has taught us that commercial property lending can result in substantial losses for banks. And the large stock of residential property debt means that it too is important both for financial stability and household resilience. The high valuation of commercial property, which is common to many other assets, increases the potential for sharp corrections and so the risks from commercial property lending. The high level of household mortgage borrowing also brings risks, both for lenders and for households. Purchases and financing by foreign investors and banks have been prominent in the current commercial property cycle. We have seen this before and are well aware of the risks that this can involve. The increase in purchases of dwellings by foreign buyers, particularly for investment purposes, is a more recent phenomenon, and so their impact on the housing market is less clear. APRA has investigated commercial property lending standards to ensure that these are not eroded, while measures by APRA and ASIC aim to reduce the riskiness of new mortgage lending. And the Reserve Bank, with its mandate for overall property stability, financial stability, will continue to closely monitor the risks from the property market and lending. Thank you for your time, and I'm now happy to take questions.
Thank you, Jonathan. Now, ladies and gentlemen, as Jonathan mentioned, he's happy to take questions from the floor. We've got Carlos there with microphones. So if you put your hands up straight, you'll get a chance to put that question to Jonathan. And please state your name clearly and the company you're from and your question. Thank you.
Hi, Jonathan. It's Philip from Channels Capital. I'd just like to ask you, even though the Chinese are only like 25% of the market for new property, okay, given that the tight market in Sydney and Melbourne for housing, that sort of incremental effect has a serious effect on prices, would you agree?
Okay. As one thing I noted is that there's actually been some increase in supply, which is directed to foreign buyers. So it's not clear that sort of the net increase in demand by foreign buyers actually constrains the market anymore. So even if we have a large share of, or a relatively large share of foreign buyers, particularly for apartments, many of those people, if they weren't buying, would have still been renting because they are here for work or study, while others purchase the property and then rent it out. So that's a property that domestic residents could then potentially be living in. So the participation of foreign buyers doesn't necessarily make the market any tighter. What is important is understanding the dynamics of those foreign buyers, and so whether they're going to be a stabilising presence or whether their presence is going to be more or flighty. And then if we've had large amounts of construction built in anticipation of their presence, if they were to leave the market, that's potentially a greater concern.
Jonathan Carrington-Clark from the ABC. There's a new report out from the ANU today suggesting that there's actually an oversupply apparent in the Australian property market. Not sure if you've seen the report, but your comment on that. And how much do you think house price rises have been driven by speculation and momentum? And if we do see either flat growth for a sustained period, perhaps price falls, will we see a lot of investors try to flee that market at the same time and potentially precipitate a crash?
I've seen the headlines from the ANU report, but I haven't had time to read the report yet. It's very difficult to estimate what oversupply is, or if there is any oversupply, to a large extent because of the household formation rate, so the number of people living in a household, because that's going to respond to prices. So a lot of people will stay at home for longer with their parents because property is so expensive, or people may live in a group house with more people living there because of the prices. So this is going to influence the amount of housing demand there is. So it's a tough one to get around. So on the second question was on the resilience of prices. And so there, if we look at the taking a longer run than perhaps your question was initially getting at, house prices over the past 30 years have increased exceptionally strongly. But a lot of that relates to the decline in inflation, in average rates of inflation from the early 1990s, which meant that interest rates came down and with lower mortgage rates, people are able to borrow more. The other contributing factor has been the financial deregulation at a similar time, which increased people's borrowing ability. So the big increase in house prices growth over this period is in part going to be a change to a new equilibrium in the level of house prices. So certainly people would, I think, be mistaken if they expected the average price growth that you've seen over the past 30 years, say, to be replicated in the future. So if we have a lower rate of house price growth going forward, and there are still cycles in the housing market, you would expect that there are going to be more frequent occasions when house prices do actually experience falls for a period of time. And so what's really important is that borrowers and other people in the market are cognizant of that and anticipate the effects that short periods of house price falls would have in a normally functioning market.
John Elvey from Madison Marcus. The build-to-rent opportunity that's coming to the marketplace now is going to be, embraced by a number of developers. Could you just give us a view as to how the banks might, what the bank's attitude might be to funding build-for-rent, which on the face of it appears as if the net return is going to be of the order of around 4%?
Okay. As I noted, Australia is different to many other countries in whereby most of the rental stock is owned by individual investors. In many other countries, you do actually have these markets where you have single apartment blocks that are owned by a single investor, which were built specifically for renting purposes. So it's obviously a style of housing that can exist and works very well in other markets. The economics of it, I guess, a lot depend on the return, and so how the tax incentives work for residential property investment by individuals as opposed to commercial entities. So it's certainly part of the market that could grow. It's going to depend on investors, what people wanting to live in apartments want, and the banks that are financing them. Certainly if we've had over time potentially a little bit of an increase in the proportion of the population who are renting, and many people comment on the absence of a market for longer term rentals, which is perhaps a function of properties being owned by individual investors. A commercial entity owning residential property for renting would perhaps be more open to having longer term rental contracts, and that may meet a demand that would be out there.
We might make that one more question, perhaps.
Based on that comment, is there any more information coming to pass or anything that you can possibly give us on the basis of holding residential property within trusts?
No, that's not something I'm going to comment on, thanks. Okay. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, please help me thank Dr. Jonathan Kearns from the RBA.